No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
Good evening. This is Michael Brown. That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues you care about. I'm your host, the United States Senator from the District of Columbia, coming to you live from America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Tonight we have a special guest. His name is Seth David Radwell, and he's the author of an incredible book called American Schism, How Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. Prior to devoting full time to writing the book, he served as CEO of the Proactive Company, the leading skincare brand for acne in America. Prior to that, he was president and chief revenue officer of Guthrie Renker and president of East Scholastic's Digital and the Global Children's Publishing Network. I'm sorry, I'm having a little problem reading tonight. In earlier roles, he was president of Bookspray, and he is a graduate of Harvard University, has a public policy, a master's degree in public policy from Harvard University School of Government and Politics, probably the best in the world, and a BA from Columbia University. He splits his time between Los Angeles and New York, and Paris. What a life. And he's here with us tonight. Thank you, Seth, for taking the time to be with us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, thank you. Let me start by asking you to define in your terms the American schism. I think we all know what it means. You know, to me, it's the divide in America. For me as a politician, it's the divide between Democrats and Republicans. But tell us what your definition of it is.
Well, it actually goes way back even before there were such thing as Democrats and Republicans. So what led me to do the work that led to the book was that I was curious and perplexed as to what we see as the divisions today. Let's say the American schism today. Was it something that's always existed, or how did it start? And so I traced, in some ways, what I call the roots of our divisions back. And when you trace them back, you see that they are a derivative of what I now call the original American schism, which happened during the founding in the 18th century. And the original American schism was a break or a split within our founding fathers, in terms of what vision for the republic we should pursue. And there was a great disagreement about that in the 1780s. And that's what the original American schism is.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at the beginning of the nation, you'll see that it's kind of amazing what they did, because they based this new form of government on a handful of books that were written by Europeans and you know, people like David Locke and Hobbes and Rousseau. But we have to remember it was a great experiment, right? They didn't go into it knowing exactly what they were doing. They thought they would come up with this new concept of rule by the majority, and they weren't even sure how that would work, right? They set up they limited the amount of people that could be included in the majority. So I certainly understand that. But tell me today, what you think is happening. First of all, let's start with what I think is the most provocative thing you said about the amygdala. Please pronounce that for me.
Let me talk about that. The piece that you're referring to, which I just had published this week, is called The Amygdala and the American Schism. And the basic argument is that there are many ways to view the American Schism today. As I mentioned, it's somewhat derivative of that first split. But one of the ways I define the schism today is that somehow, and there are reasons why this has happened, which are quite perplexing, but somehow there's been a new canvas, a new way of thinking that's overlaid our politics. And it's a way of thinking that is very primitive. It's based on fear and anger and rage. And those are all, those emotions are not part of our rational brain. They're part of kind of a primitive brain where there's an organ called the amygdala, which is what creates that fight versus flight response. It's how we all have it as humans. It's actually, what's interesting, Michael, is that for millennia, thousands of years ago, it was the amygdala-driven protection that allowed us to survive because it taught early humans how to escape or how to fight. So these aspects of our brain are very important. But what I argue in that article that you're referring to is that we've allowed them to take over our rational debate. So in our public sector, where we're supposed to be solving problems, we allowed unreason and fear and anger to crowd out rational thinking. And that's no way to solve problems. And I think that's a major problem. And so, you know, in essence, what I'm calling on my fellow citizens to do is realize that we all know how great it feels to root for your tribe and root against the other team. But let's keep that behavior and that mindset good for the sports stadium, because that's where it's meant to be sublimated, not in terms of solving public policy problems.
Well, you know, it's amazing that you use a sports analogy, because that's exactly what I see out there. That's exactly what I see, that you're more interested in having your team win than anything else, you know, and that really just supplant your enthusiasm for your team and your team identity really does supplant the way you think, the rational thought process involved. We all go out there and root, right? I've been a football fan for many, many years, and I remember an instance in where a Redskin spit in the face of a New York Giant. And the referee turned around and saw it and penalized the Giants because the guy, of course, reacted by pushing them or hitting them or something. And that moved the ball up, and Skins won the game because they kicked a field goal. And there were people in the Washington Post that defended that said, oh, yeah, look, he won the game. It was the right thing to do, because they no longer cared about the civility of doing something, you know, which we would all consider an insult. They really didn't care about that as much as they cared about winning, because that's the bottom line, right? So tell me how this has, in your opinion, or your opinion of the American schism, has formed us into groups where our identity is now linked to the group instead of you as an individual.
So this is something that's happened over the past couple of decades. It hasn't been a sudden thing, but it does feel like in the most recent years it's gotten much worse. And what's interesting about it, if you look at the research, it turns out that Americans are actually less divided on policy differences than you would think from their anger at each other. So it's almost like the tribes, as you mentioned, the identity politics of whether you're with this team or that team, it's overtaken the actual policy differences. So how did it start? Well, I would say there are two fundamental drivers that have created this. The first one is you have to look at the nature of the media industry today. What we used to call the journalism industry, the news industry, has been supplanted by a new business model that searches for clicks or eyeballs at the expense of anything else. Whereas the journalism really grew up in the early part of the last century as the pursuit of truth, which was a profession that very much developed an ethos about how important truth and verification and facts were at the center of the industry. Now, since that time, in recent years, the model for eyeballs, whether it's clicks or eyeballs on TV, has supplanted the old model. And one of the things that's happened, Michael, is it turns out that to get more eyeballs and clicks, rage and sensationalism work much better than facts and then at that truth. So the media industry is one key driver, I think, of what's happened. We've allowed the whole idea of independent and let's call it, you know, nonpartisan news and reporting to escape us, to go away. One of the things I'll mention for your listeners is that 20 years ago, there were over 20,000 local newspapers in the country, in every town and village. And so as a consequence, there were hundreds of thousands of reporters learning how to do the industry, learning how to be good journalists. And in the last 20 years, thanks to the internet and what was the classifieds, which was the way local newspapers made money, around 85% of those papers, those local papers, have disappeared. So local news has vanished. And I think we paid a big price. So I would say one part of it is the journalism disappearance and the media industry as it's defined today.
So let me ask you, I keep on hearing on, you know, Meet the Press and all these news programs, when they bring out the Democratic political pundits who, you know, then they say the country's so divided and the country's so, the election's so close. What Biden needs to do is go out there and tell everybody what he's done in a democracy and what the economy, how he's increased the economy and done all these things. Well, these policy things, what, if he goes out there and talks about policy, will that make a difference? If will the other camp even listen?
Well, that's what's so interesting. You know, so I was going to say, besides media, the other half of the equation that's made us in the situation we are, where it's all about rage and anger and acrimony, is, I think, the electoral industry, the industry itself. In other words, the political parties. Because a couple of cycles ago, back in probably in the 90s, I think both political parties learned that the way to mobilize voters, the way to win elections, was not by proposing complex solutions or going through data or analysis. The way to win elections was by pushing buttons that scared the electorate, demonizing the other side. This kind of tribal politics was very much pursued by both political parties. And I do blame both parties. I think it did take, you know, one of the major turning points, I think, that you have to look at is when Newt Gingrich became speaker back, you know, like 20 years ago now. There was a conscious effort at that time to fill the political dialogue with invective and to characterize opponents as enemies of the American people. And, you know, both sides did it, but I think Gingrich kind of kicked it off in a big way. And that was really the start of the decline of civility in political discussions. It's where we lost the respect for bipartisanship, where despite differences in policy, politicians of both camps really work with the other side to try to forge solutions. And that has slowly gone away. And now what I think allows politicians to win elections is by making sure that their electorate looks at the other side as the enemy, as the demon that's trying to hurt America. And that's very unhealthy for our democracy.
I agree with that. And the role of the media, the internet media, social media, has really exacerbated this, has it not? Because politics has always been dirty. I mean, you know, that there's always been nasty things said about both sides, right? And you know, people have mean things to say about George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, although we don't remember most of that. And but now we get our news from one source, right? And that source is the source we look for. It's not, we don't try to be objective anymore, do we?
most Americans don't. And that's part of the problem, is that they call them the information bubbles, are so one-sided. And the idea of, in the media, of what I think we grew up with, Michael, like a Walter Cronkite, who would really just, you know, tell the news, what happened in the world. That idea, that concept of news is really vanished. And it's been replaced by these, what I think shouldn't be able to be called news programs, these opinion shows whose goal is to try to attract viewers by stroking them and feeding their fears and confirming their biases. So it's very unfortunate. Now, let me just preface this by saying, you know, one of the beauties of the work that's in the book American Schism, I think, is that to understand how we dealt with this, it's important to look at our history. So it turns out that, as you mentioned, there were fierce debates between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. They were on two different sides of the original American Schism, and there was a lot of hatred there as well. But what you find is that when you look across the divisions in our history, and this is very much what the book does, it looks across five different eras of our history in terms of how divided we were. When you do that analysis, what you realize is that at times we found what I call a secret sauce, a magic formula for how to move forward and get past our differences, not to resolve them completely, but to still be able to make progress. And when we've used that secret sauce, we've had pretty good outcomes. When we haven't, we've had tremendous violence like the Civil War. So I think that history can teach us something. One of the first episodes that's discussed in the book is that the 11 years between 1776 and 1787, because in those 11 years, there was a huge split. That was the original schism. And yet we managed to forge the compromise that became the blueprint for the nation, which was the Constitution, which was very much a compromise. It had, in many ways, a splitting of the problem between what the Democratic Republicans wanted, which was one side of the split, and what the Federalists wanted, which was the other side. And the result is a combination. And that is an example where, despite these very strong differences, in the name of building this new nation, having won the war, we were able to come together and create this blueprint, which, of course, Benjamin Franklin, as he was leaving the Constitutional Convention, when asked, well, what have you guys created? He said, to a reporter asked him that, he said, it's a republic, if you can keep it. Recognizing how difficult it would be to maintain.
Right, and how true those words, how they ring true today. And it's interesting that you use Walter Cronkite, because we all got our news from Walter Cronkite, right? Both sides did. And we don't do that anymore. Now, you know, the left has a Walter Cronkite and the right has a Walter Cronkite. I mean, I watched this thing after the Trump trial, or try to figure out what's going on both sides. So I watched Fox and I watched CNN and MSNBC, and it was like they weren't even talking about the same trial.
It's like a different reality completely.
Right. No matter who you agree with, it was like, you know, they just weren't talking about the same facts. And yeah, we've redefined reality, haven't we? As Conway said when she was at the White House, alternative facts. What an incredible idea, right? That my facts and your facts are different, but they're both valid and they're both true. So let me ask you, because this is a big question. Well, first, let's talk about globalization. Because you talk about globalization and you talk about what this did to the American economy and what it did to the people that were in rural America, and this is something the Democrats do not get. They do not get at all that these people really are aggrieved. You know, I have friends that live in border towns, and I'm telling you what they tell me, that's real pain. No matter how you feel about immigration, these people really hurt down there. They have a real problem. And it seems that somehow we've ignored the way this electorate feels.
Yeah. Now, not only do they have a real problem, but Michael, it's gone on for three generations. I mean, let's put ourselves in rural America for a second. You know, the people who are suffering today, their grandparents originally lost their jobs to outsourcing in the 80s and 90s. So they were already paying two generations ago. And then their parents, with those economies terribly shrinking, their parents try to find jobs as independent businesses and struggled. And now many people in the third generation are also struggling with economies that have been devastated. And there's a raging opioid epidemic going on. So if you contrast, you know, 40 years ago, the towns that had 4th of July parades and strong church communities and a vibrant social civic sector, those parts of America have been hollowed out. They've been devastated. And I think part of the problem for the Democratic Party is that you know, the elites on the coast, so to speak, have not understood that. In fact, you know, one of the amazing things that's happened is for a long time, both parties showed disdain for the working class America. If you remember, you know, Mitt Romney's calling them takers and Hillary Clinton's deplorables. I mean, in essence, both the Democrats and Republicans who are governing the establishment did not understand and respond to the pain. And that's what's led to this incredible populism that is manifested with Trump, because Trump, for many of these people, he answered what was their call, if you will. And I think it's one way in which Trump was extremely powerful and smart is that he recognized how many Americans were not being served by the political system of the 90s, 2000s, 2010s.
Well, you know, I think personally that all you have to do is sit down a bunch of Trump people and talk to them about Trump, and they're proof that the things you say are absolutely true, because what do they say? They go, yeah, well, we don't like him. Yeah, well, he you know, we wish he wouldn't speak so much. Yeah, well, we, you know, yes, he grabs women, he does all these things, but we're still going to stick with him because he's part of our group. And that's it, right? You're part of the group.
Right.
So tell me, why do we take an insult against the group as an insult against us? Well, how have we internalized this and made this personal for us? Is that due to the piece of the brain whose name I can't pronounce?
So one of the amazing things about tribal politics or identity politics is that often when you identify yourself as part of a group, when someone attacks the group, you take it personally, and then you respond with like-minded attacks. This is findings from social psychology and group psychology. So these are normal responses, but again, it's not helpful or productive to use that identity political framework or tribal framework for public problem solving. That's why we have sports to get those emotions out, if you will. And you know, almost any issue, Michael, that we could talk about really requires what I would say are facts and compromise. And there are complex issues. Let's take immigration. We've been screaming about immigration for 20 years now. You know, we're screaming about building walls and open borders and all this stuff. When in fact, if you look at immigration, there's a set of issues related to challenges with immigration, about border security, about asylum policy, a whole bunch of things that's very complex. So four times in the last 20 years, we've had a comprehensive immigration reform bill that none of them were perfect, but each time these bills tried to take into account many of the issues related to immigration and propose compromise solutions. And four times they got far enough that they were kind of on the floor of our Congress, but they never passed. Because we prefer, as citizens, it's more satisfying somehow to scream about open borders or building walls than to solve the problem. And I think it's a good example of how this kind of tribal politics is not serving us well.
Well, it's a great example, because the last bill that you talk about was actually a bipartisan compromise, and it still failed, right?
Yes.
It still failed because the leader of the group said, don't pass it. Don't pass.
Why would he say, I mean, how could you put that political motivation above the needs of the nation? It's infuriating to me. And I think both sides have been very much acting in that manner.
Well, and it's scary because what, you know, the bottom line of what you talk about, or so far as what I've read, are that it leads to bad choices. And we have bad choices. So let me ask you, when it comes to global warming or global climate change, which is a big problem for all of us, right? Does the fact that globalization had such an impact on so many people, does that make them reticent about embracing worldwide solutions to this problem? We all know that none of us can solve the problem by ourselves, right? We can't solve it. Europeans can't solve it. The Asians can't solve it. But does our reticence to embrace, kind of a global solution to this, does this lead back to our group politics?
Yeah, I think what's happened is there's tremendous distrust of public institutions and institutions that purport to be global. So let's go back to the globalization as a concept. I mean, we've been pursuing an economic policy since really Reagan and before in this country, so 40 years, that's based on this notion of global economy. In technical terms, it's called neoliberalism. It was invented actually in the post-war years. But the point is that like all models, or like all economic models, there are winners and losers in those models. And in the globalization model, the key winner in my mind has been India and China. Because in China alone, they've now, so many Western countries have outsourced manufacturing to China and services as well. What it's allowed the Chinese, think about it this way, of almost a billion people in China have come out of poverty in 25, 30 years. That's how productive it's been for China. So they've been the winner. And the losers have been our white working class, the people in rural America. So that model has not worked. So now you look at that globalization model, which has failed miserably, and we've been reluctant to admit it. And you say we're going to use that same model to solve global warming or climate change. People are very skeptical, and they have a right to be. And it leaves us in a real mess, because the truth is that the climate crisis, in my view, is getting worse. And I think the science is very clear on this. And in this world of information bubbles and alternative facts, there are many citizens who don't accept it, who don't listen to it.
It's crazy, too, because the facts are out there, and you don't even have to look on either side, right? All you have to do is listen to TV. California is always on fire, or there's a hurricane, or there's twice as many tornadoes as we've ever seen, these crazy floods that have happened, right, over the past 10 years. And this is what scientists were saying 20 years ago, were they not, that this was what was going to happen, and it's exactly what's happening, and people are still ignoring it, right, and still in denial. It's just amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's very sad, because it goes to this whole notion of the distrust of science now, and I think that's very dangerous. I mean, if one of the things that the book American Schism discusses a lot is the Enlightenment and why it's so important. And for your listeners who don't know, the Enlightenment was a period of time in the 17th and 18th centuries where there was a newfound appreciation for human knowledge and the pursuit of knowledge in many areas. It was a broad movement. And it was so important because it helped us figure out as a society, as a civilization, how to build upon problem solving, one thing leading to the next. We've created what has been called the Constitution of Knowledge. So if you look at the overall results of it over the long frame, it's been amazing. But I'll give you a couple of stats. Before the Enlightenment, 250 years ago, life expectancy on the planet was 30 years. Now it's over 70 years everywhere on the planet. 250 years ago, 1 in 4 children didn't survive till age 5. Now, of course, almost all do. The point being is that this constitution of knowledge that we've built, this scientific approach, which thanks to the Enlightenment framework and the scientific revolution, has served human prosperity very well. But yet today, what we see is too many people, Americans and other countries, too willing to cast it aside and let go of this kind of notion of fact-based decision-making. That's very dangerous. I think we jettison the Enlightenment framework to our own peril. And when you mention climate change, there's a very sensible framework for how it can be dealt with, but it does require global coordination. And the way that is, economists would call the climate change is created largely by carbon, which is a cost, which is being emitted by firms who don't pay for it. It's what's called in economic terms an externality. In other words, if we're both competing, let's say, Michael, you and I in a sector, we're both making products, and neither of us are our profits are the revenue we earn minus the costs, but neither of us are paying for the cost of emitting carbon. And so if we had a form of carbon tax where we could monetize that, we would have a way of not having carbon emission be an externality. And it's a whole different framework of how to think about it. Like, you know, we have in the private sector, firms, public firms anyway, they have certain requirements. They have to post every quarter their earnings per share and how much profit they made, how much revenue they earned. Why don't we require firms to post how much carbon they emitted for every dollar of earnings, or other statistics that help to show and put a spotlight on the cost they're causing to the environment? So that what I'm saying is there are ways to deal with it, but it requires this coordination that we've become as Americans so distrustworthy of.
Well, we just had somebody Skype in a question to us, and this is it. I would ask Seth, how does he think the secrets of the two enlightenments will solve our divide if it hasn't for centuries? How do you feel?
I love that question.
Yeah, by the way, just so I can point that out, it comes from my neuroscientist friend who was supposed to be on the show tonight, but unfortunately she's sick, so she couldn't make it.
I'm glad she asked that question. So what the book does, in essence, is go through five episodes where we've had those divisions, and it assesses how we've dealt with them. And before I referred to the secret sauce, and the way to resolve it is by using the secret sauce. And it sounds simple, and it's not, of course. There are three elements of the secret sauce. So let me specify it for your listeners. I mean, I'm simplifying. I hope they will check out the book because it goes into much greater detail. But here are the three elements. In order to make progress on almost any issue, the first element is that you have to agree to operate in a fact-based empirical framework, where you're not allowing emotions to overwhelm the facts. As business people know who lead companies, data matters. And if in order to problem solve, you have to put the data first and forward. So that's the first part of the secret sauce, the magic formula. Operating in an empirical framework, which too often today we don't do. Now, the second one is what I call in the book deep listening. Now, let me explain that because often people don't understand it. It sounds simple. I'm not talking about listening in the sense of giving heed to an argument by someone else. I'm talking about the deep listening that allowed us in school when I was a kid to go into debate club and develop an argument that was rational and logical to support a point of view using facts and using data. And then taking a flip and understanding and doing the same thing for the other point of view so that you could see and really understand what the contrary point of view to something meant. And that type of deep listening, really understanding the logic and the thinking behind a point of view different from your own, is fundamental. And it's part of what used to be a key part of our civic education, that kind of empathetic listening and evaluation, and I think we've lost it. The third element is compromise. So anybody who solved complex problems knows that the solution always requires fundamental compromises. You never get everything you want, And today, it seems like we've thrown the notion of compromise under the bus. So to the listener who asked that question, if we put those three principles back in place and put them front and center, I think we'll start to heal the American schism. Now, it's much easier said than done. In the book, I talk about two ways to do this. One set of changes are what I call mindset changes, changes in how we interact with each other as citizens, so how we relate and what citizenship means. And that part emphasizes that citizenship is not only about our rights, but our responsibilities, okay? And then the other side of the equation are structural changes to change the incentive system. So I mentioned before how there's this incredible incentive to make voters scared and to push their buttons. And there's a lot of structural ways we could fix that with simple changes. One example of that, and I could go into more detail, would be things like open primaries. So right now, I don't know if your listeners understand this, but if you take the Congress, the U.S. Congress, 435 members, right now, 8% of the electorate, 8%, elect 85% of those congressmen and women, only 8%. And the reason that is because most of those districts are safe. And because they're safe, it's the primary that matters. And very few people vote in the primary. They're usually the party die-hard. So independents in many states can vote in the primaries. So what you have is you have the democracy being decided by a very small sliver of the electorate. And that, with election reform, we can take away. So again, just to summarize, Michael, this requires mindset changes and structural changes. We need both.
Well, and I think I talked to you about this briefly. I think ranked choice voting is one of the bad choices that has come out of just what you said. I think we're desperate to find a way to keep the 8% from making these decisions. And I've been elected three times in Washington, D.C., and it's all about the primary. If you win the Democratic primary, because 80% of us are Democrats, if you win the Democratic primary in Washington, then you automatically win the election. No, you know, the Washington Post even calls you the winner after the primary. It's amazing. But so we're looking for ways to resolve that, and that's one of the bad choices we're making by giving people a ton of different choices and making it so complicated and ending up very often with the second best candidate. Before we go any further, though, tell people how they can get the book. I think it's so important for people to read this book, so please tell them how they can get it.
Well, American Schism is available on Amazon, of course, and it's available in bookstores, but it's most easily available online. And there's both a hardcover version and there's a Kindle version, an ebook version. So you can get it almost anywhere. And I love to hear from listeners. So if you're interested in learning more about the book, you can go to AmericanSchismBook.com. It's a mouthful. American, S-C-H-I-S-M, Schism, Book, B-O-O-K.com. And there you can find interviews with me and my discussion of the book in more detail, as well as find places where you can buy it. And I think it's won the International Book Award last year. I'm very proud of that. So the book has, in fact, struck a chord with many people on both the left and right. And I think it's a valuable contribution that I can play in trying to heal the American schism.
Well, I think calling it a contribution is an understatement. I think it really, really speaks to so many things that I don't hear other people speaking about. And I encourage people to get that book, and we will post your website on our website, on the radio website, after the show. You can go there too and get it. But you say in 2024, our challenge seems to be to distance ourselves from the pressures of our self-chosen mobs. And how do we do that? How do we come to that? We use the secret sauce. That's the way to get to regain our individuality or our individual thought.
Here's the thing, Michael. It's very interesting. The research shows, the research that I've done for the book and all the research that I've used shows that about 70% of Americans realized that the approach we're now using is counterproductive. It's not working. Yet, so that's the majority, 70%. But they feel like they're in the minority because the extremes on both sides scream the loudest. And that's who gets right. airtime on TV. Right. So you have what's often been called, I call it the frustrated majority. Now, and the frustrated majority, they're also the exhausted majority because they're so tired of these fights. They recognize there's got to be a better way to solve problems. But they're silenced because they feel like they're not in them, and they're afraid to speak out. Now, many leaders in the private sector, for example, I think are part of this frustrated majority, CEOs, C-level people, because remember, what they do all day is they solve problems to grow their businesses. And they're often afraid of speaking out because they don't want to be canceled or bring on the acrimony of some group or be drowned out. So it's risky. But the fact is that that frustrated majority has got to take back the gavel. We've got to wrestle the gavel back and take control of the conversation. And so that speaks to some of these mindset changes. So there's a group, for example, that I've worked with called Braver Angels. You may have heard of them.
Yes.
And their whole purpose is to get Republicans and Democrats in localities together to talk to each other like human beings. I'm not talking about talk to each other online and tweet at each other, but to sit down using a set of guidelines and rules and respect each other and disagree. And it's almost like that's a lost art. I think we need to do that. I think we need as Americans to learn how to disagree respectfully. And Braver Angels is one of the organizations that's doing that. There are other ones. There are other organizations that are working in this mindset space, this bridging space, trying to build bridges between rural America and cities, between different parts, different races, different people. That building those bridges is going to be essential, because as long as we feel like we're all so different and we don't understand, we have less in common with our fellow Americans, the more that these divisions can fester.
Well, you know, I think that's essential, because as you point out, and this is absolutely true, we actually have more in common than what separates us, right? We all love our children. We all want a better life. We all want, you know, to see, we all love America. We want it to succeed. Yeah, and it's really a little crazy that we let these things get in our way instead of sitting down and talking about what our commonality is. And I think you're absolutely right about that. So how do we do that? How do we get people to do that? Because I think there's a misunderstanding, a serious misunderstanding on each side. And like with Democrats, I don't think that the women's movement understands, for example, how they've made women without college educations feel. You know what I mean? We've promoted women, we pushed them, we said get educated, but now we see that stay-at-home moms feel like they're, you know, like you point out, a generation ago, they were, you know, heralded in our society. Now it's kind of looked down upon, like they're not being all they can be. So how do we get the sides to sit down and have that discussion?
I totally agree with what you're saying, but let's even take another example that to me is more extreme in a way. Why is it that so many on the left don't lionize and respect our police officers and our firefighters? It used to be that when I grew up, those professions, everyone recognized how difficult they were, and there was a tremendous amount of respect when you passed the fire station. And, you know, those frontline jobs, I was hoping, Michael, that during COVID, we would realize that nurses, teachers, healthcare workers, firefighters, these are what make a society work. And so the answer to your question is, I think we got to, first of all, figure out how we can't take these things for granted. I think what we've become, the new generations in America have become too complacent. A society as advanced as we've built doesn't happen by itself. We have these frontline workers who are providing the infrastructure that benefit us all. And I think that that's been forgotten. And, you know, part of, I talk about this in the book as well, that, you know, we've, the education system in our country, and I'm talking now about primary and secondary education, we've focused in the last 30 years on what's often been called in the industry STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And there's no doubt that those are important. In this world today that's so technologically advanced, we need our kids to be educated, and there's always fear when we fall behind in math and science, so that's true. But we've also allowed those topics to crowd out our civic education. And if we're going to live in a society together, we need to understand how to respect other points of view and these other elements of the economy that are so fundamental for us living in peace. And I think we've lost that. So education is going to be is part of the solution here, but it has to be education that's available to more people and that doesn't let the civic side of education disappear.
Yeah, I mean, you need no clearer example of that than what happened at the Capitol on January 11th, that the party of law and order went up there and assaulted police officers. Actually, two police officers died as a result. It was more important to support the group, to support Donald Trump, than it was to support the idea that these men were there to protect all of us. So I agree 100%. And we're seeing that in Washington right now. You know, we were after George Floyd, which was a horrible incident. You know, we all watched a black man get murdered in front of us on TV. It was a horrible event. But after that, we made many changes locally to change the police department so that we've lost 600 officers. And now crime is our number one priority in Washington, and we're doing everything we can to try to get those people back, which isn't working very well. But you know, so that's a perfect example of what you're talking about. Okay, well, we're starting to run out of time here, Seth. We got about another 10 minutes, but tell me, what is it that I'm not asking you that you want to say? Is there something important that you want to add that we're really not getting to here?
Well, yes. I mean, I think in the sense that you know, many of the changes that I talk about in the book are, they seem like it's very difficult to accomplish. I'll give you one example. You know, I talk about how money and, you know, donations from corporate big money interests in many ways have hurt our politics. And there are ways to get reforms passed in these areas. There's a lot of local organizations across America, often operating at the state level or the local level, that are working in ways to bring Americans together and to do these bridging examples that I provided before. So I would encourage your listeners to understand what's happening in their community. You know, sometimes when you look at local problems, there's a more of a willingness to realize there are different points of view and to compromise. And I think that's an example where we all as Americans can look, whether it's our local churches or synagogues or mosques or our local community centers. Those are areas where there's a lot of points of view that often come together in a discussion that can be civil. And I would encourage your listeners to get themselves involved in those and learn more. I have a bunch of those organizations listed on my website as well. So that's one thing I wanted to mention. That starts the healing process, I think, right off the bat.
Well, give the website again, because I think that's very important. And I'm going to go to your website and get those organizations. We're going to put on our website too, because I think it's really important for people to do exactly that. So tell us how we get your website.
The book website is americanschismbook.com, I mentioned before. And then I have my own website where I have some of these resources, SethDavidRadwell.com, my name. And you can put those links into the show notes so people can see
them. Yeah, we will.
And I engage with listeners, with readers all the time, so you can also reach out to me directly. My goal is to try to start a dialogue that's more productive. And Michael, one of the ways I focus on that, because I'm a CEO and I've led businesses, I'm often talking to business leaders who are afraid to speak out on many issues. And I'm trying to explain to them that, you know, CEOs or C-level business people have been successful thanks to this incredible country that we have, which is, of course, the best example of self-government in the history of the world, even with its flaws. Yeah. And I think if we hope to bestow a democratic republic, this wonderful experiment in self-government to our children, we owe it to ourselves to defend our democracy and to fight for it. And, I think too many Americans are sitting on the sidelines because they're part of this frustrated majority. And that's not going to work. You've got to get engaged.
Well, let me ask you, since you are a business leader and since you, you mentioned it's a business several times, the bottom line in business is profit. And the bottom line today seems, according to this information anyway, is the group. How do we change the bottom line in politics? Do we need to change the bottom line in politics from winning?
Yeah, we need to change. Well, in the corporate sector, in the business sector, I think we have to remember that you know, a civil society, a rule of order, and a society that's not completely divided and tearing itself apart, overall is better for business. I've talked to a lot of business leaders, let's say, from Venezuela, who can't believe that a generation ago they had an operating economy that's now been destroyed. So you know, businesses need a stable environment where the rule of law matters and where they can conduct business in a healthy way. That's number one. Number two, I think businesses also recognize that they don't want tremendous divisiveness, tremendous fighting, hurting their employees or getting in the way of getting their jobs done. And that's, in many cases, the polarization has reached a level where it's creating dysfunction in the workplace. So for those reasons alone, I think it's important that business leaders are attuned to some of these problems. And, you know, I try to, when I sit down with CEOs, I try to tell them, show them ways they can get engaged, which are completely nonpartisan. I mean, I reject often being partisan because I think it's important to recognize that there's a lot of things in terms of participation, in terms of engagement, that are even before partisanship about what democracy means and about getting involved. And those are things that corporate leaders, C-level people can be very active on.
That's great advice. And again, we've only got a few minutes left, so let me encourage people, because you're right. We have this democracy is worth fighting for, and the alternatives are all bad. The alternatives to democracy are not good. But we both have a master's degree in public policy, so we both studied good policies and bad policies over the years, and it's time for us to get, and it's the only way we can make good policy, is it not? If we do it together, if one side makes the policy and the other side's excluded, there's no way that can work in a democracy, is it? And you know what, real quickly, if you can say, because this is a question I've had on my mind for a long time. Has this all added to our sense of who we are as Americans? I mean, when I was a kid, there was a thing called being an American. We all disliked, when I was in college, we all protested against Richard Nixon and the war in Vietnam. But none of us, really, not very many of us, disagreed that America was the world's greatest country and that we were happy that we lived here and proud of this. It seems we've lost all that, or a lot of it anyway.
I agree. I think that's a shame. I think, you know, if you look across the last century, I think in the 1900s, the large major issue, the battle of the century, if you will, was this idea of an open liberal society like we had versus other forms of organization like communism and fascism. Yeah. And that battle, I think, we won. With a lot of lives were lost for those battles, remember. A lot of Americans gave their lives for this form of government and this freedom that we have. Now, in this century, it seems like the battle is shaping up between one between that same open liberal society and these models of autocracy that are increasingly popping up, where you have a strongman leader who takes control and consolidates power, and people lose that those freedoms and rights. So I think, once again, I think our society is worth standing up for and fighting for. And I'm hopeful that fellow Americans will realize that we have more in common with each other than that which divides us.
Well, I agree. And that's a perfect way to end the show. And thank you so much for being on our show. I encourage everybody to go out and get this book. I'm going to do it as soon as we get off the air. I'm going to go online and get a copy. And I think I've read some of it, and I think that we should all read all of it. That it's important as we move forward. And don't forget, on Tuesday in Washington D.C. is primary day. So everybody, go out and vote. Let's get everybody working in the instead of just a handful of us going out on the primaries. Everybody go out and vote in the primaries. But we leave our show each week. We play out with a song. We dedicate it usually to our guests. So here's one for Seth David Radwell. Thanks so much for being on the show. This is Elvis Presley with Suspicious Minds.
Oh, I love
thank
it.
You.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see? Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.